Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this Critic podcast, recorded whilst Britain and the Commonwealth prepare for the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, the historian Professor Jeremy Black talks with The Critic's deputy editor, Graeme Stewart, about the Queen's place in British history.
Now, much of the obituarisation of the Queen referred to her character and made justifiably positive remarks about its exemplary nature. I indeed tried to do the same in my obituary. And that goes without saying. The Queen was a figure of enormous probity. Her integrity was a matter not only of her personality, but also the way she saw the monarchy. She had a deep faith, and she worked extraordinarily hard, was a support to her ministers, maintained the prestige of the royal family, and also did the basic dynastic duty, which seems to have most of the obituaries seem to have ignored the fact of producing an heir and 3 spares as well. And I have compared her in my obituary to George III, who ruled from 1760 to 1820, again, a very long reign, and again came to the throne young. He was born in 1738. And I think that that comparison stands in many respects, in the diligence, in the piety, in producing a large family, in George III's case, very much larger, 15 children, having difficulties with those children, no two ways about it, and also being a wide-ranging individual, which was true of both George and Elizabeth II. I think it's fair to say that there was a certain amount of sneering, not least about whether the Queen was interested in books. This is completely ridiculous. The Queen was a wide-ranging and thoughtful person who had a great understanding of the nature of British culture and the particular value of specific arts. Now, Winston Churchill, of course, was very keen when the Queen succeeded in 1952, he was Prime Minister, to see her period as a new Elizabethan age. And in doing so, Churchill, who had a deep feeling for national continuity, was very much hoping, praying, one might say, that there might be a national revival under the Queen after the difficult years of the resolute years, but difficult years of the 1940s, and that Britain might, as it were, be a great nation as he saw Elizabeth I's reign. Well, I think the parallels are more interesting than one might imagine. And interestingly enough, of course, when Churchill made those remarks in 1952, Britain still had enormous significance. It had the largest empire in the world still. It had the second largest navy after the United States. It was the third largest power in terms of achieving nuclear status, etc., etc. But if we go back to Elizabeth I, and I'm not sure Churchill would have actually considered this aspect of it so well, there was a parallel. Because Elizabeth I's reign was a great reign and an important reign, and it served thereafter to be a context either for criticism of failures in succeeding reigns or to provide a resonance that was regarded as acceptable. But I think it's also needs to be noted that Elizabeth I's reign had many problems of its own, including for the monarch and the monarchy. There were some problems that you do not see in Elizabeth II's reign. Elizabeth I didn't marry. There was not a secure succession. The most likely succession was in the Stuart line, and until Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed for treason, which was slightly dubious legally, because, of course, she was a sovereign of another state. But until she was executed for treason, the succession of the Stuarts would have meant the succession of a Catholic. So I think it's fair to say that on that very most basic of levels, Elizabeth II had a stronger position than Elizabeth I. And in case listeners think this is a rather ridiculous remark, remark to make. May I point out that the other great monarchy in the world at the moment, which is the Japanese monarchy, has been having considerable difficulties in ensuring its dynastic succession. So this is something that is pertinent. But there are also, of course, issues in the reign of Elizabeth I that are worth thinking about. The last 13 years of her reign, for example, were years of extraordinary difficulty in economic terms, in social terms, in terms of intractable conflicts with Spain and Ireland, in terms of difficulties, major difficulties with Parliament, in terms of an unsuccessful pseudo-coup in 1601 from the Queen's favourite, the Earl of Essex, which was a product of division among the Queen's ministers. And if you go back through the reign, there were many problems. I mean, you know, leaving aside, obviously, attempts to assassinate, to murder Elizabeth I, there was the Northern Rising at the end of the 1560s, there was the excommunication by the Pope, etc., etc. So I think it's fair to say that if one is considering the reign of Elizabeth II, which obviously takes place in a very different context, now, in one respect, you might argue that the period was that in which the monarchy ceased, the dynasty ceased to provide the monarch to many parts of what had been the British Empire, and that represented a limitation of the sway of the monarchy. And in traditional terms, I think that would be a fair point to make. And in terms of the substitute, the Commonwealth, which obviously the Queen held very dear, and which provides an important constituent of soft power, and which British prime ministers have valued. I know Theresa May, because she spoke to me about this, told me that she valued it greatly. But I think it is fair to say that popular opinion within Britain has been considerably less convinced by the Commonwealth than was the extent of imperial sentiment, shall we say, a century ago. So there is that change that needs to be said. There is also, of course, the role of contingency. The Queen's reign saw an armed insurrection in Northern Ireland. That armed insurrection was unsuccessful, but one would be naive if one didn't realise that it posed obviously an issue for royal authority in Northern Ireland. Or indeed, much more recently, the general election of 2017 saw 40% of those who voted vote for Labour, led by Jeremy Corbyn, who was then, I think it's fair to say, a revolutionary Trotskyite, of marked Republican sympathies. And I think it's fair to say that had he won the general election, there would not necessarily have been a continuance for long of monarchy as it then existed. And, you know, probably, very probably, if there'd been a referendum on the continuance of the monarchy, the monarchists would have won. I certainly hope they would have won. But on the other hand, revolutionary Marxists, Trotskyites, are not noted once they gain power or influence for necessarily paying much attention to the views of the public. So I think one has to say that the Queen's success, which owes a lot to her personality, also reflected in part circumstances. And here again, we can have echoes both of the first Elizabeth's reign and also of her father's reign, George VI. The first Elizabeth would have been totally unsuccessful had Philip II of Spain, her former brother-in-law, landed in England as a result of the Spanish Armada in 1588. She would have been obviously completely unsuccessful had she been murdered in one or other of the conspiracies, Babington plot, for example, the Ridolfi conspiracy, linked to support for Mary, Queen of Scots. George VI, or indeed earlier, George III, would have fallen had, in the case of George VI, there been a German invasion, Operation Sea Lion, in 1940, and in the case of George III, had the French succeeded in 1805, the year of Trafalgar. So one needs to be aware that contingencies play a very important part. And obviously, if the Cold War had ended differently, or it had become a hot war, or indeed, for that matter, if terrorist atrocities, whether initiated by the Provisional IRA or by another body, another organisation, had they cut short the royal family's existence, then the situation might have been different. And, you know, it is not an idle point to bear in mind at the present moment that we have a secure inheritance in the case of first Charles III and then the new Prince of Wales and his three children. I think it would be fair to say that the popularity of those are greater than the popularity of, shall we say, the King Charles's cadet line versus via Prince Harry. So I just make that point to draw attention to the extent to which dynastic chance plays a role, and the Queen can only have been expected to have done so much to secure the monarchy. Taking that forward, if one considers the obituaries, they are generally praising her. They draw attention to a number of failings. Number one, that in 1963, she followed Harold Macmillan's advice in asking the Earl of Hume to be Prime Minister, as opposed to more popular Conservative parliamentarians, Reginald Maudlin, for example, R.A. Butler, Quentin Hailsham. And that, I think, is a reasonable point. I mean, I think it's worth bearing in mind that we now have complaints about the election of Conservative leaders and the length of time it takes. In 1963, when we had a far quicker process and there was no election, now people complain from that angle. I think it's fair to say that there was criticism. Equally, I think it's fair to say that Macmillan was trying to play explicitly a Viscount Melbourne kind of role vis-a-vis Victoria, and it was difficult for the Queen to have resisted his influence. I think with time she became more confident of her constitutional position, but I think it's fair to say that as a result of the abdication crisis, as a result of the degree of nervousness of George VI and the extent to which, I mean, as it were, he'd been shoved full of a view of Badgett, and as a result of the way in which the Queen had inherited that position, the possibilities for a stronger monarchy vis-a-vis domestic politics, seen, for example, by Edward VII, and the Parliament Act crisis of 1910, or seen with George V and the national government crisis of 1931, I think it's fair to say that the Queen had been brought up not to think about taking that line. Whether that was wise or not is a matter of opinion, and it's a matter we could debate, but it certainly was significant. And there's no two ways of saying something is right or wrong. That's foolish. One has to be aware of choices. Linked to this awareness of choices, though, comes, of course, the choices not taken. And I think it's fair to say that if you think of 1963, you're aware that this is a period of a sense of decay in Britain. Indeed, a sense of decay in Britain had gathered pace in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis in 1956, and for Macmillan himself in the aftermath of his failure to achieve economic growth. And for those of you who are interested, I did discuss this in my book on Ian Fleming, how in his later years he captured this in his James Bond novels. Now, as we know, many countries that have a sense of decay and failure are apt to turn to the extremes. And in the case of France, for example, this led in the late 50s to the fall of the Fourth Republic. It led to terrorism against the Fifth Republic, the OAS. It led to a crisis on the streets of Paris in 1968. In the case of Italy, there were conspiracies and conspiratorial groups on both the left and the right. I think it's fair to say what is interesting in Britain is that, with the exception of Northern Ireland, there was not really anything that there was the equivalent of. There were, of course, some far left figures, some of them, of course, in receipt of money from the Soviet Union, and other several Labour MPs were, as it were, agents acts of either active agents or agents of influence for the Iron Curtain countries. And on the far right, there was talk in the 1960s during the Wilson years of a kind of coup, a government of national unity. It would have been a government of national disunity in practice, but a government of national unity. I think it's very important that dynastic continuity in the person of the Queen helped to, as it were, give a sense of stability. Again, of course, chance plays a role. There was, as it were, a king beyond the water in the person of Edward VIII, but Edward VIII was both ineffective, pathetic, and had had no children. So he was not really in a position to try and act as a rallying point for a rather stale attempt to overthrow the British system. If you look then at the subsequent criticisms of aspects of the Queen's rule, they are divided essentially between personal issues. Was she the best mother for her children? I think as a father myself, I think that's an extraordinarily difficult call to make from the outside. One never knows about the dynamics of relations between children and parents. It's too easy for outsiders to suggest things which are not necessarily sound observations. And I don't think it's a particularly helpful line to pursue. There's no reason to believe that she wasn't, in her personal context, a warm and loving mother for her children. Obviously, they went, you know, to boarding schools, but that was the norm in her social background, not some result of some personal weakness. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that there was an argument that the Queen in the 1990s was not successful so much in freshening up an image of monarchy, and that in particular she was put on the back foot by the public disquiet after the death of Princess Diana. Again, I think one has to be very careful on this point. The Queen was in a very difficult position, both personally and as a monarch. There was a sort of febrile public mood. It was a kind of, as it were, almost like the age of narcissistic social narcissism before social media, in terms of a lot of the public emoting at the time. And I'm not sure that it was easy for her. Obviously, Tony Blair tried to thrust himself into the position. And again, I'm not sure that his stance necessarily helped matters. He was a constitutional innovator in the case of Scotland, Wales, the House of Lords, and he wanted to set up regional parliaments in England. In a sense, he didn't touch the monarchy, but he did try and almost shadow it in the People's Princess line, etc. And there were clearly tensions at the time. I myself was acting as advisor to the Royal Mail in that period. And the Labour government of Mr. Blair wanted a series entirely properly, entirely appropriately on the national health system. And they wanted one of the stamps to be of an Iron Bevan. Well, there is a principle in postal stamps that you don't, in fact, have very many individuals put on, particularly those who are politically contentious. And the post office wasn't happy about this. It was put under pressure from Number 10, but the Queen took a strong interest in what appeared in her stamps as she saw them. They had her head on them after all. And in the end, there wasn't a stamp with Mr. Bevan on them, on it. And you know, there were clearly tensions. I thought of all the periods of visual image of the Queen, the time I saw her looking most unhappy was at the time when she had to take part in that ludicrous sham that Blair produced for the Millennium and the Millennium Dome, a sort of really very unattractive image of Britain. So there were difficulties. I thought Gordon Brown had an interesting point when he said that looking forward, as it were, into the future for the monarchy, and he made this point before the death of the Queen, he said looking forward, it would probably be better if the monarchy was seen not so much in terms of backgrounds of those of social individuals at a high level. I'm not sure how easy that is. I mean, in a sense that how people perceive others is a matter often of perception rather than whatever one means by reality in this context. And, you know, there is no doubt that the royals spend a large amount of their time with people who are very much of a humbler rank and humbler place in society than indeed many members of parliament do. So I'm not sure quite how one wants to take that one forward, but I think that in a way, Gordon Brown had a point of view. Looking to the future, there is obviously a whole set of questions and assumptions that come into play, not least because the background at the present moment is that of very widespread and understandable grief, a strong sense of the identity of individuals and families as being bound up in a collective memory in which the monarchy plays a very important role. And in that context, in Britain, Republicans are being wise to be silent. You'll always find some idiots in the universities sounding off, but on the whole, Republicans are being wise to be silent. But obviously there are issues. If Northern Ireland, for example, unites with the Republic, which may well happen within the lifetime of, shall we say, a young person now, then one would assume that it would be as part of a Republican solution, which would be the end of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So again, if Scotland becomes independent, I think the current show of strong loyalty in Scotland would give Scottish ministers pause for thought about becoming a republic. But on the other hand, one has seen how Republican sentiment can build up in what were loyal parts, monarchical parts, of the former dominions, Australia being a classic example, where although the new prime minister has said he doesn't think there'll be a republic for a while, nevertheless, he is a republican and was able to win office accordingly. So I think one is actually looking in the long term to a number of issues which the monarchy needs to consider. As far as England itself is concerned, or Britain understood in terms of the current arrangements, in other words, without any separatism, the monarchy has come through the last reign much stronger than might have appeared possible in the 1990s. It has an ability to draw on a very powerful groundswell of opinion. And while a lot of that rests on affection, indeed love, for the person of the Queen, a lot of it also rests on a sense that the monarchy is important and that the monarchy is part of national identity. And this is not simply a matter of a lack of support for republicanism. After all, would you really want a republican election between, shall we say, Stephen Fry for the left and Jeremy Clarkson for the right or whatever? It would be rather, it might contribute to the humour of nations, but I don't think it would be very good for Britain. But, you know, whilst the support for monarchy rests on a deeper level, a level of identity, a level, in fact, of nationalism and a level of patriotism, nevertheless, it is the case, as we know, that the patriotism and nationalism and national consciousness of people can be affected by calamity, and that there are groups within the country who do not share these values.
I just want to dive in and pick up on a few of the really many themes you have you've run with in what you've been saying. And one is, I thought you very interesting comparisons with the first Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth I, also George III, and I'd also add Victoria. These are three previous monarchs, which all of whom have in common, they were on the throne for a long time. For the most part, and you know, not throughout, but for the most part, they were monarchs during times when England and then Britain was gaining self-confidence. I take your point about the last years of Elizabeth I's reign being difficult, but nevertheless, in the main, Elizabeth I, George III, Queen Victoria, these are seen as reigns which took place at the same time, growing confidence in the country. In the case of Elizabeth, as you point out, this is a period of relative decline, and yet some of the tensions that relative or real decline has had in other countries haven't really been blamed on her or passed on her. I wonder if you could just unpick a little bit more as to why that is. Is it just simply an aspect of the elected politicians taking the heat? Or is there something about the way in which Queen Elizabeth ruled as a constitutional monarch which allowed her to be absolved of any blame for difficult times?
Well, I think, first of all, I think she justifiably is absolved from blame, as you put it. I mean, in a way, a cardinal failing of the British has been and remains wishing to live beyond their means, both in terms of domestic living standards and the state, but also what the state provides, but also in terms of a view of the world. And I'm not sure that one would blame the Queen for that, or indeed any monarch for that. I think that it's interesting that if you look at the Parliament Act crisis of 1910 and the national government of 1931, you don't see the monarch really taking any significant blame over, if you wish to use that term, over either, even though they were important. And I think that's because although the monarchs were important, they didn't strut the stage in a way that politicians did. And I think that that was really quite important to the way in which they were perceived. Going back earlier, I'm not sure I would agree with you that monarchs necessarily were presiding over easy days. I mean, George III, for example, who I think is the monarch who most is similar to the Queen, also lost an empire in the case of, you know, the 13 colonies in North America, and faced, of course, insurrection in Ireland and a really difficult war with France. So I would say that monarchs have had major difficulties before the Queen. I would agree with you that Britain's decline in relative terms has been very great. Obviously, the British have been able to hide that in part by the stories they tell themselves, but in part by the fortuitous provision of North Sea energy, which from the 1970s on really did transform the situation. And then as that, as it were, seriously began to run out in the 2000s, they then debauched the future, the currency, and spent the future with quantitative easing. And since both major political parties have been committed to this, I think it's not surprising that the full sense of the mess we are in has failed to be brought home. What is interesting is if you look at the present difficulties, it shows how institutions that were much respected can hit a lot of problems. The public opinion polls indicate that the reputation of the National Health Service is much lower than it was even a year ago. And if doctors go on strike, it will be far lower. I think it's fair to say that whereas the BBC at one time was regarded as a somewhat stuffy, but nevertheless repository of national fairness, now it's very much seen as a partisan body full of people paying themselves vast salaries. So I think what's interesting is institutions can change their public reputation very, very, very rapidly. So far, that has been avoided over the last quarter century. In other words, since the Princess Diana death and the issues arising in the aftermath. But obviously, we know there can be serious problems.
I wonder if we can probe exactly how the Queen has handled her constitutional role as distinct from previous members of the House of Windsor. I'm thinking particularly of George V and George VI. Has she understood her role in any really fundamentally different way to how her father and grandfather understood their role?
Well, I think certainly I wouldn't say any really different role to George VI, her father. As I was trying to indicate earlier, I think one has to be a little bit more cautious here in considering the idea of a grand kind of tradition, Burke and all the rest of it. I think there was, under George V, a more active role prior to World War I, during World War I, and thereafter in influencing the choice of prime ministers and in trying to make sure that the political system worked in a period of really quite significant constitutional change. And the very fact that he seems to have been able to do it successfully is probably why it doesn't come to the surface very much. And also, of course, George V had interest, stamp collecting, for example, which are not those that generally are noted among, as it were, would-be authoritarians. So his public image, well, you know, man who liked sailing, I mean, on the day he formed the national government, he took the royal family to go and see a performance of Cavalcade, a sort of musical comedy, in London. He'd earlier, of course, famously been to a music hall. You know, he used the radio to make his Christmas broadcasts. He had a democratic tone, particularly going to football matches as well. But he also had a view that the king had a duty to try and get the political system to work. Now, what I would suggest to you is that the Queen was in a much harder position when the political system did appear to break down, 1973 to 1976, and then when it was threatened by large-scale domestic instability in the shape of the miners' strike and terrorism on the mainland by the Provisional IRA, including an attempt to murder the Prime Minister, in the mid-1980s. Now, in the latter case, the ability of the Prime Minister to see off these crises was crucial. I think it would have been very interesting to see what constitutional and political positions the Queen would have taken had there been a more acute crisis arising either from a successful miners' strike or from the assassination of the Prime Minister or both. In the 70s, we know that the Queen in 1974 urged Wilson not to hold the second election early. She felt, as early as he wanted, she felt that this would be a cause of problems. What we don't know is the extent to which she, as it were, exercised her influence thereafter in favour of stabilisation at a time of enormous national difficulty.
I want to ask a final question, if I may. At the time of the attempt by Boris Johnson's government to prorogue Parliament, the Queen granted that prorogation only to find the Supreme Government effectively overturning what was her decision, as if she was in effect under a trance or held hostage by the Prime Minister and didn't have free will in making a royal prerogative decision. Do you see this as a sign that actually the constitutional law has shifted and the role of the monarch has become a rubber stamp without being accorded its own will?
Well, I think that's very interesting. And the position of the Supreme Court, I think, was one. I was asked by the BBC if I wanted to give an interview, and I told them what I wanted to say, and then what a surprise, they didn't want to hear it, which so they didn't broadcast it. But what I was trying to explain is that a constitution is not simply a set of legal agreements, but also a set of practices, working practices, devised like the legal agreements around a notion of fitness for purpose. And that as a result of that, I argued, and the BBC didn't wish to hear this, that the Supreme Court was not necessarily, because of its legalistic approach, was not necessarily best placed to understand the Constitution. So I think that there was a case in 2019 in which we were approaching a significant political impasse. Now, that put the Queen in a very difficult position. Not that she was held captive by the Prime Minister or anything like that. She wanted and needed to have the political system work, as indeed the country did as a whole, which either meant that Parliament had to try and resolve the issues in front of it, or that there needed to be a dissolution of Parliament and a fresh election in order, as in, you know, with the 1911 elections over the Parliament Act controversy, or the elections in the early 1830s over the Reform Act controversy, to try and resolve the issue. And that should have been a position taken by people across the political spectrum, from left to right, from, you know, wherever people were on the Brexit or Remain position. I think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court was extremely unhelpful. I would say actually very foolish myself. And I have been told by two Lords of Appeal that they were very dubious about the judgment of the Supreme Court. And one of the Lords of Appeal was very scathing about the legal knowledge of Lady Hale, for example. So, who I think was a divorce lawyer in background, not exactly the best person placed to assess constitutional issues. So, leaving that point aside, I think the ironic situation is that the impasse was resolved by parliamentarians not realizing that if they provoked a election by allowing the government to hold a general election, there would actually be a sea change granted as a result of that. And this was a sea change which made the position of the Supreme Court somewhat irrelevant, and which in a way ended up in supporting what was the tendency of the Queen, which was entirely in accordance with the Constitution, which was to move forward the political process and produce a solution, whether people liked or disliked the solution, rather than leaving what had become a national millstone.
Thank you very much, Professor Black, for talking us through different aspects and a wider historical perspective on the life of Britain's longest reigning monarch, Her Late Majesty Elizabeth II. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And I hope listeners have found that of some interest. I mean, let me say on behalf of both Graham, who is somewhere else in Ely, I think, at the present moment, and myself speaking from Exeter, that there is enormous sorrow, and the trying to address these issues in terms of rational debate is not in any way intended to underrate the emotional strain that many individuals are experiencing at the present moment.
That's very true indeed, very true indeed. Thank you very much, Professor Black.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.